Today is July the 27th, 2022. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.live, L-I-V-E, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is also available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. What might replace silicon in semiconductors? Moore's law is not based on any scientific principle, but an observation by Gordon Moore of Intel. Gordon Moore stated that the speed and capability of computers can be expected to double every 2 years. As a result of increases in the number of transistors a microchip can contain, we have now reached the material limits of silicon down to one atom. So would there be anything to replace silicon? After all, we have an abundance of sand on the planet Earth. MIT discovers new material for semiconductor that can perform far better than silicon. Researchers from MIT and elsewhere have found a material that can perform much better than silicon. The next step is finding practical and economic ways to manufacture it. Silicon is one of the most plentiful elements on Earth, and in its pure form, the semiconductor material has become the foundation of much of modern technology, including microelectronic computer chips and solar cells. However, silicon's properties as a semiconductor are actually far from ideal. One reason is that although silicon allows electrons to readily flow through its structure, it is much less accommodating to holes or electrons' positively charged counterparts, and harnessing both is crucial for particular types of devices. Furthermore, silicon does a poor job of transporting heat, which contributes to the frequent overheating problems and, well, all those pricey cooling systems that's necessary in the computers. Now, a team of scientists from MIT and the University of Houston and other institutions have carried out experiments showing that a material called cubic boron arsenide overcomes both of these limitations. In addition to providing high mobility to both electrons and holes, it has excellent thermoconductivity. It is the best semiconductor material ever found, and maybe the best possible one, according to the researchers. Cubic boron arsenide has so far only been made and tested in small, lab-scale batches that are not uniform. In fact, in order to test small regions within the material, the scientists had to use special methods originally developed by MIT. More work will be needed to determine whether cubic boron arsenide can be made in a practical, economical form, much less replace the ubiquitous silicon. But even in the near future, researchers say the material could find some uses where its unique properties would make a significant difference. These findings were reported on July the 21st of this year in the journal Science. Earlier research had theoretically predicted that the material would have high thermal conductivity. Subsequent work experimentally proved that prediction. This latest work completes the analysis by experimentally confirming a prediction made back in 2018. That cubic boron arsenide would also have very high mobility for both electrons and holes, which makes this material really unique. The earlier experiments demonstrated that the thermoconductivity of cubic boron arsenide is almost 10 times greater than that of silicon, so that is very attractive just for heat dissipation. They also showed that the material has very good band gap, a property that gives it great potential as a semiconductor material. Silicon has good electron mobility, but poor hole mobility, and other materials such as gallium arsenide, widely used for lasers, similarly have good mobility for electrons, but not for holes. Heat now is a major bottleneck for many electronics. Silicon carbide is replacing silicon for power electronics in major EV industries, including Tesla, since it has 3 times higher thermal conductivity than silicon despite its lower electrical mobilities. Imagine what boron arsenides can achieve with 10 times greater thermal conductivity and much higher mobility than silicon. It can be a game changer. The critical milestone that makes this discovery possible are advances in ultra-fast laser grading systems at MIT. Without that technique, it would not have been possible to demonstrate the material's high mobility for electrons and holes. The electronic properties of cubic boron arsenide were initially predicted based on quantum mechanical density function. Those predictions have now been validated through experiments conducted at MIT using optical detection methods on samples made by members of the team at the University of Houston. Not only is the material's thermal conductivity the best of any semiconductor, but the scientists also say it has the third best thermal conductivity of any material next to diamond and isotopically enriched cubic boron nitride. This is impressive, because no other than graphene that has all these properties. The challenge now is to figure out practical ways of making this material in usable quantities and, of course, bring it to market. Silicon is the workhorse of the entire industry. So we've got a material that's better, but is it actually going to offset the industry? We don't know. While the material appears to be almost an ideal semiconductor, whether it can actually get into a device and replace some of the current market, well, that's still yet to be proven. And while the thermal and electrical properties have been shown to be excellent, there are many other properties of a material that have yet to be tested, such as its long-term stability. For commercial use, the challenge would now be to produce and purify cubic boron arsenide as effectively as silicon. Silicon took decades to win the crown, having a purity of 99.999999999%, or 10 nines for mass production today. What might Voyager 1 and 2 do for an encore? We've had great successes with Voyager 1 and 2, but what will be the future of NASA's aging Voyager spacecraft, which over the last 45 years have collected data no human-made probes have ever gathered? Why it matters. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are the only functional human-made spacecraft currently in interstellar space. Both spacecraft, which launched to space in August, which was Voyager 2, and September, which was Voyager 1 back in 1977, are not only scientific tools, but emissaries of humanity, carrying golden records that contain images, music, and even a map for an alien civilization that one day may run across it to find us. No spacecraft is going to get back to where Voyager 1 and 2 are for decades. The Voyager science team will meet to discuss the science that the spacecraft have been beaming back and talk about the future of the mission before making recommendations to NASA on how to proceed to get the best science from the aging probes. The Voyager team will propose to NASA asking the agency to again extend its mission so it can continue to gather information about this mysterious part of space. Even as the Voyagers age and encounter technical difficulties, keeping them functioning remains a high priority because of their data is unique. Mission controllers have turned off instruments on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 that weren't deemed essential to the interstellar mission. The team will need to start turning off functional instruments that are sending home important science to conserve power. At present, Voyager 1 is in the midst of a somewhat confounding anomaly involving how it communicates with its controller back on Earth. When NASA sends a command for Voyager 1 to point in a certain direction, even the probe isn't able to tell them it understood and is executing on the order, even though it follows a direction. Its transmission ability is garbled, but its action, well, they're fine. Troubleshooting the problem is going to be quite complicated by the fact that it takes more than 21 hours to send a command to Voyager 1 and then a 21 hours to receive a message back because of its extreme distance from Earth. Unlike many of these scientific things you watch on TV, you don't ask a question in deep space and immediately get an answer back the way it's televised. The mission's long life also works against current mission managers in another way. Many of the people who used to work with Voyager, particularly those who were around before launch and during construction, are no longer working with the mission. Today, NASA has processes for making sure that the technical specifications of any given spacecraft set for launch are digitized and available to the right people, but when Voyagers were being built, that wasn't the case, further complicating attempts to fix the spacecraft. They may never get to the root cause. In spite of all that, mission managers have devised a way to potentially keep the probes, which were designed for a 5-year primary mission, functioning through 2030s. Instead of just allowing the spacecraft power supplies to slowly deplete, the mission managers may be able to manage voltage in a way that would allow the spacecraft's power to exceed current expectations. There is optimism that the mission can be extended to 2030, but 2035 and 2040, well, it would be miraculous. But it's Voyager. Nobody thought the spacecraft would still be operational in 2022. The big picture. Both of the spacecrafts are currently flying through interstellar space, but they're on different trajectories, allowing scientists on Earth to learn more about that part of space from two perspectives. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 also have complementary instruments that are still functioning. Voyager 1 currently has 4 working instruments. Voyager 2 has 5, and 4 of the 5 are the same instruments as Voyager 1. Having multiple and complementary data points from each spacecraft allows scientists to build more robust models of interstellar medium and its nature. The probes have revealed the complex ways that the sun interacts with interstellar medium, showing that the sun does influence the space between stars. How advanced was the computer that they use on Voyager 1 and 2? There are 3 different computer types on the Voyager spacecraft, and there are 2 of each kind. The Voyager spacecraft computers are interrupt-driven computer, similar to processors used in general-purpose computers, with a few special instructions for increased efficiency. The programming is a form of assembly language. Voyager was built in-house at the Jet Propulsion Lab. The computers were manufactured by General Electric. Voyager 1 and 2 were launched in 1977 and probably designed around 1973 or 1974. Back then, microprocessors were just cutting-edge technology. The Intel 4004 came out in 1971. Voyager's computers did not use microprocessors for 2 reasons. Space engineers tend to be conservative and only pick proven parts with strong reliability track records, and the processor needed to be radiation hard. Instead, the computers probably were made out of discrete parts, that is to say, resistors. An unthinkable thought today is that we're still using 50-plus-year-old computers on space missions. Hey, Windows wasn't available, and if it had been available, I don't think it would have been chosen. The FCC broadband maps and proposed internet speed standards. The long-awaited broadband data update from the FCC seems to be slow in release, so Microsoft created its own broadband mapping tool. Microsoft released its own new interactive tool to help identify broadband inequities in the United States. Microsoft has long been a critic of the FCC's broadband maps, and Microsoft has released its own new interactive tool to help identify places in the United States that are unserved and underserved. The tool, created by Microsoft, aggregates public data from the Census Bureau, the FCC, Broadband Now, and Microsoft's own broadband usage data. It goes census tract by census tract, examining 20 different indicators of digital equity, such as broadband access, usage, education, and poverty rates. This data provides an aggregated score of digital inequities in the community. Microsoft said its tool is necessary because of the inadequacies of the FCC's maps. It gave the example of Ferry County in Washington, where the FCC claims that only 0.4% of households lack access to broadband. But according to Microsoft, 97% of the county is not using the internet at broadband speeds, and more than a third of households don't even have a desktop or laptop to use the broadband available to them. The dashboard by Microsoft also confirms what we have long known. The digital divide isn't just felt in rural areas, it also deeply impacts cities. In Los Angeles County, where Microsoft was working with partner Starry to expand access to affordable broadband, more than a quarter of the residents aren't using the internet at broadband speeds. And roughly one in five households lack a desktop or laptop computer, cutting off millions from the digital world. Microsoft says the dashboard was created with the best data possible at a deep level to assist policymakers in identifying key places within their state so they can direct funding. In the meantime, the FCC chair proposes new U.S. broadband standard of 100 megabits per second down and 20 megabits per second up. The FCC chairwoman, Jessica Rosenworcel, is aiming to increase the agency's broadband speed standard from 25 megabits per second to 100 megabits per second on the download side, and from 3 megabits per second to 20 megabits per second for uploads. Rosenworcel's notice of inquiry proposed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. The FCC said in an announcement that Rosenworcel is also proposing a separate national goal of 1 gigabits per second and 500 megabits per second for the future. The current 25 and 3 megabits per second was adopted in January of 2015 under then-chairman Tom Wheeler, and it was never updated by former chairman Ajit Pai during his four-year term leading the commission. Pai decided in January 2021 that 25 megabits per second download and 3 megabits per second upload speeds were still fast enough for home internet users. The needs of internet users long ago surpassed the FCC's 25.3 speed metric, especially during a global health pandemic that moved so much of life online. Rosenworcel said in the announcement that the 25.3 metric isn't just behind the times, it's a harmful one because it masks the extent to which low-income neighborhoods and rural communities are being left behind and left offline. Rosenworcel circulated the proposed notice of inquiry to fellow commissioners, and the proposal requires a vote, and the commission is still deadlocked with two Democrats and two Republicans as the Senate continues its inaction on Biden's nominee, Gigi Sohn. Under U.S. law, the FCC is required to determine annually whether advanced telecommunications capability is being deployed to all Americans in a reasonable and timely fashion, and to take immediate action to accelerate deployment and promote competition if current deployment is not reasonable and timely. Maintaining the 25.3 megabits per second standard for home internet service made it easier for Pi to give the telecom industry and FCC passing grades in the annual reports. Rosenworcel also wants to expand the commission's deployment analysis to consider prices and adoption, among other things. Looking beyond speed, Chairwoman Rosenworcel also proposes that the commission consider affordability, adoption, availability, and equitable access as part of its determination as to whether broadband is being deployed in a reasonable and timely fashion. If the FCC raises the speed standard and evaluates affordability, it's more likely to find that broadband isn't being deployed in a reasonable and timely fashion. But Rosenworcel will need a 3-2 Democratic majority to reverse PI's broadband industry deregulation and reclaim authority to treat Internet service providers as common carriers, so the practical outcome to the speed standard change would be limited unless a third Democrat is confirmed to the FCC. I have a question here. Raising the speed standard was long overdue, but without accurate broadband mapping, how does one know where the infrastructure needs to be improved or replaced? Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series, Keeping Ahead After Return to Office.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is the section where I start giving you ideas on how all of the IT world is doing in the business environment. And Jack reached out to me. What have I learned in the return to office after working from home? Now, this is kind of a tricky situation because I am still in that hybrid mode and I'm going in just a little bit. It's not a matter of I'm fully in the office, but there are a number of different things which still do apply. So let's talk about this. Performance is really king. It's still king. Performance is always going to be there, and you need to ensure that you are making a difference in the workplace. Metrics. This is probably going to be one of the big areas here for everybody. Metrics count. And if you can show the numbers where you are the winner, where you are in first place, these are quantifiable numbers where you can show, hey, I sold more widgets than anybody else in our department. I made more profit. I made more this, that, or the other thing. This is always going to help. Now, there is something called gaming the system, and you need to know how to game the system and work these numbers. Now, when I say gaming the system, I want to be very careful. I do not advocate doing anything dishonest. I will never advocate doing something that is inappropriate or not businesslike or anything like that. But you should understand what the metrics are that really count. What are the different areas where those numbers are going to be the best benefit for you, as well as your strengths? What are the areas where you can really excel? So, in support, in IT support, which is something I'm no longer really heavily involved with, but in IT support, there are multiple metrics. One of those metrics, the number of phone calls. And if you are really good at making a number of phone calls or receiving a number of phone calls or whatever, that's where you focus. Maybe your metrics, the high metrics that they're counting on, aren't how many fixes you do, but how many people that you manage to get through in the span of 8 hours. Then again, maybe it isn't so much a matter of how many people you get through. Maybe it's your customer service rankings. Maybe it is a matter of how happy those people are at the end of the day. And this is where you make it your quest to create happy customers within all of your abilities. And you find ways to, again, with the first one, go through more phone calls. You know what? This is a really busy time. Let me call you back. I'm going to do a little bit of research and I'm going to call you back. And you get to call them back at a slower time. That's one way to handle more phone calls, because you're going through at the heavy time and then dealing with all of the problems during the slow time. But that customer service ranking, you've got to remember to keep that up. So there's a number of different things there. creating happy customers by making them feel important, making them feel like you are giving them the best focus you can. And sometimes that's just a little bit of the wording. Yeah, it's really busy. I'm going to call you back later. No, that's not good. You know what? I want to give your problem just a little bit more focus. And right now I'm under a little bit of stress. Let me do this. If I can call you back today, later on, if about 4 o'clock, would that work for you? And I will be able to spend a lot more time with you and we'll get this solved. Which one makes you feel better? Yeah, that second one. Now you have to make sure you call them at four. You have to be there for them. You have to make sure that that customer service ranking is going up. But you've just added in some of that. Now maybe your metrics are the closed service calls. So you close down a number of different calls, these different items, but also make sure you're looking for additional ways to close smaller, quick items that indicate that you're saving money and efforts later for the company. And this is something that we see this as that add-on sale, that little thing that, you know, you're going through the supermarket and you've got a whole tray of, you know, basket of groceries and they've got all of these little things. Would you like to get some gum today? Some candy? There's great candy bars over there. You know, it's just that little add-on sale that really helps. Now, if you're measured in all three areas, again, you're going to find out what your strengths are. You're going to shoot to be the best in at least one, if not two, of those areas. And that always helps. If you're at the top of the good metrics, that's great. The last item I'm going to talk about is communication. And communication is paramount. It is right up there with performance, but this is something that, and I've known these, all of these items, I haven't relearned them. I haven't learned them. It's something that I know is valuable and I know is what's keeping me employed. So communication, all kinds of, well, not all kinds of communications. I want you to lead in the communication world and you'll lead in the real world, but this isn't talking about gossip. This isn't knowing the water cooler talk or any of that. It's knowing the business, knowing how to improve the business, bringing that to the table, bringing that efficiency to the table, bringing that, just as I discussed about, hey, I want to spend more time with you. I want to focus with you and making people feel better. That level of communication is so much more important than the whole, I'll call you back later. You know, the I'll call you back later is just dismissive. So you've got to work on your communication skills and ask people, are you communicating well? Are you doing the best you can? And find out and seek to improve your serve. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. There are hard disk drives and there are hard disk drives. Well, that is no longer true. Today there are CMR hard disk drives and there are SMR hard disk drives. What's the difference? Since 2015, hard disk manufacturers have produced a new type of drive, SMR, which stores more data per disk, but comes with some drawbacks compared to the conventional storage method called CMR. Each type has pros and cons, so let's take a look at it. There are two different ways of storing data on a disk. Hard drives store data in tracks, which are circular paths typically oriented in concentric rings on the top and bottom surfaces of a hard disk platter. Each hard disk unit can contain multiple platters, which allows the drive to store more data. Historically, manufacturers have increased storage capacity in hard disk models by either increasing the number of platters in the drive or increasing the write density on the disk. In the past, the circular tracks written to the disk never overlapped. The data storage industry calls this perpendicular magnetic recording, or PMR, or conventional magnetic recording, with the acronym CMR. Recently, a new technique for increasing write density called shingled magnetic recording, or SMR, has emerged. SMR drives write data using a special method that partially overwrites previously written tracks on a hard disk platter. The manufacturers use the analogy of a roof shingles that partially overlap each other to explain this technique, which is where the shingled part of the name comes from. While SMR drives increase capacity for lower cost because the drives can use fewer platters than a CMR drive at the same capacity, the way they work also comes with a speed penalty. When you copy data to an SMR drive, the drive temporarily stores the data in a special cache area and uses idle time later to organize it into shingled regions on the platter. Long sustained writes suffer speed penalties because if the cache fills up, each time an SMR drive overwrites part of a previous track, it must read and rewrite the partially covered underlying data as well. So SMR drives can perform dramatically slower than CMR drives. SMR slow performance led to a controversy in 2020 and 2021 when people realized that manufacturers were selling SMR drives without labeling them in both external hard disk and internal drives, arguably selling an inferior product without warning customers. Some of these companies even led to a $2.7 million class action settlement with Western Digital just last year. So is SMR bad? Which drive type should you choose? Whether SMR is bad or not is a subjective call. If you want massive amounts of storage for less money, and you don't mind the performance penalties involved, an SMR drive might be an okay choice for you. Typically, a 16 terabyte SMR drive costs less than a 16 terabyte CMR drive. For example, if you use a drive for occasional single disk backup, an SMR drive might just be fine. But beware, a major drawback of SMR found in testing by Serve the Home is that using a slow SMR drive in a RAID array can put the entire array's data at risk for longer because it takes far longer for the SMR drive to get integrated into the array. So using an SMR drive in a NAS, a network attached storage with multiple disks, is probably not a good idea. Luckily, some manufacturers such as Seagate have begun publishing data online that clearly shows which drives in their lineup uses SMR or CMR technology. Although most still do not clearly label the drives as SMR or CMR when you purchase them from a retailer. Still, with this data in your hands, you can now make a more informed purchasing decision, such as selecting a CMR drive to use in a home-built external USB drive. Caveat emptor. Seagate is working on increasing hard disk drive recording density. Seagate describes SMR as a stopgap recording technology where reads can be made smaller, but write heads cannot. The downside is that if data has to be rewritten, then track blocks have to be reconstructed, which takes time and lengthens disk write performance. However, Seagate is developing its second generation HAMR hard disk drive that would be probably around 30 terabytes. Seagate's call this technique HAMR, which is an acronym for heat-assisted magnetic recording. Seagate announced next-gen HAMR hard disk drives are coming in mid-2023, with capacities of over 30 terabytes. More mammoth HAMR HDDs are coming, 40 terabytes in 2024 and 50 terabytes in 2025. According to Seagate, the HAMR process has no effect on drive temperature or the temperature, stability, and reliability of the media. Seagate plans to combine HAMR technology with SMR or shingle magnetic recording. HAMR drives incorporating SMR technology may suffer from some of the same performance issues as SMR when data isn't written in large sequences. Until it comes to market for lab testing, We will not know if heat assist in magnetic recording will impact read-write performance, and also how it might impact SMR recording. When purchasing a computer system, do you configure it with a hard disk drive or a solid state drive? The invention of the hard disk drive dates back to December of 1954. It was invented by IBM. The hard disk drive is not extinct at all. A hard disk drive, or with the acronym HDD, is a hardware device used for storing data. This specific type of storage device uses magnetic recording to store and retrieve data. Specifically, a typical HDD or hard disk drive has two critical parts: a paired magnetic head that writes and reads data on a spinning magnet-coated metal platter. Data is accessed in a random access manner, meaning that individual blocks of data can be stored and retrieved in any order. Hard disk drives are a type of non-volatile storage, retaining stored data when powered off. Modern hard disk drives are typically in the form of a small rectangular box. Both a magnetic head and metal platter are moving parts. These parts differentiate a hard disk drive from a solid-state drive. A solid-state drive uses non-moving interconnected flash memories for storing and retrieving data. However, although hard disk drives are currently more popular, solid device units are becoming more prominent in computers where portability and form factor are important considerations. Hence, hard disk drives are regularly pitted against solid-state drives. The advantage of the hard disk drive when compared to the solid-state drive is price. It's cheaper in cost for the same storage capacity. A hard disk drive is more affordable than a solid-state drive in consideration of dollar pricing per gigabyte. Then there is a larger base storage capacity of the hard disk drive over a solid-state drive in system configurations. Systems with hard disk drives start at 512 gigabytes, whereas systems configurations with solid-state drives start at 128 gigabytes. The minimum storage requirements for Microsoft Windows starts at 64 gigabytes, and of course you will need more than 128 gigabytes to accommodate your application programs and your data files. Another advantage of a hard disk drive is market availability. There is an abundance of internal and external hard disk drives from different manufacturers that have flooded the market. Although solid-state drives are becoming more available, it is still more convenient to opt for a hard disk drive due to accessibility in addition to affordability and highest storage options. Another benefit of using a hard disk drive over a solid-state drive is its longevity based on higher read-write cycles. Note that there is only a limited number of times data can be stored and retrieved on a solid-state drive because it is flash memories having finite number of writes. Unlike a hard disk drive, a solid-state drive needs to erase and rewrite large blocks of data at one time before writing a single bit of data. Repetitive read-write cycles shorten the lifespan of flash memories. When compared to a solid-state drive, is the speed it writes and reads data. A solid-state drive is faster than a hard disk drive in this regard. A hard disk drive consumes more power than a solid-state drive. Essentially, a hard disk drive needs more power input to operate its moving parts, whereas a solid-state drive promotes energy efficiency and lengthens before the need to recharge the battery. The hard disk drive generates a higher noise level with its mechanical sound. A solid-state drive does not produce any mechanical sound. Perhaps the most notable disadvantage of a hard disk drive when compared to a solid-state drive is its susceptibility to data loss and integrity failure due to physical vulnerability. The moving parts of a hard disk drive makes it vulnerable to damages due to drops and shutters. This is the reason why a solid-state drive is more appropriate for laptops or portable computers. Similarly, an external solid-state drive is more durable than an external hard disk drive. Note that moving and carrying a device increases the risk of physical damage. The form factor of a hard disk drive is bulkier than a solid-state drive. Manufacturers cannot reduce the size of a hard disk drive because they need to take into consideration the placement and operation of its moving parts. Hence, this physical limitation makes hard disk drives unsuitable for applications in which mobility and smaller physical profiles are important factors. Hence, ultra-thin laptops and devices such as smartphones and tablets are equipped with solid-state devices. There are no functional differences between the hard disk drive and the solid-state drive. If you need extra large storage capacity, or if you're on a tight budget, the hard disk drive has the advantage when buying a system. If, however, speed of information flowing through the system is a major factor, the solid-state drive is the storage of choice. Does hibernating my PC save more energy than sleep? When you shut down the system, what's the difference between sleep versus hibernate? Windows has two main options for shutting down your PC without really shutting it down: sleep and hibernate. There are some key differences between these two modes, but which one actually uses the least electricity? And what's the difference between sleep and hibernate? Neither mode fully shuts down your PC, but they do very different things. Sleep is essentially a low-powered mode. The PC state is kept in memory, but the other parts of the PC are shut down. This is what allows it to very quickly resume where you left off when you turn the PC back on. Sleep mode is sort of like a light nap. Power modes on Windows. Hibernate saves the current state to the hard drive instead of memory. When you power the PC back on, it loads that state back to the memory. Since the state is saved to the hard drive, the PC can essentially shut down completely while still resuming where you left off when it's powered on. It does take a little longer to boot up from hibernating than sleep, though. Sleep mode should typically be used if you're just stepping away for a short period of time, whereas hibernate is better for situations like going to sleep for the night. Both save more energy than keeping the PC on continuously when you're not using it. Which one uses more energy? Hibernating does save more energy than sleep. Is it a considerable difference? There's only one way to find out. Try it out. A PC that's hibernating supposedly uses about the same amount of power as one that's completely shut down. As mentioned, that's why it takes longer to boot up. While both sleep and hibernate are still technically powered on, sleep mode is more awake than hibernate that takes more power. Clearly, both modes are conserving more power than if you just left the machine on. Sleep mode doesn't use much power, but hibernate uses even less. That's the mode you should be using to conserve the most power. Don't even bother shutting down your PC. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston with their Tech Chatter. Tech hoarding costs the hoarders.
Marty Winston joins me now. You know, it's funny, Marty. I thought of you when I started going through this bag. Someone gave me this big, huge bag of old cables.
Did it have candy bars?
No, computer cables. We're talking the old Centronics printer cables. I haven't seen one of these in ages. There are cables that we used to sell for like $30, $40, $50 at Radio Shack back when I worked there. One of the things years ago, Marty and I both worked at Radio Shack at different points in time, different levels within the company. You were a lot higher of a level than I was.
I was in the stores before I ever worked in headquarters. It wasn't a direct transition.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, yeah, I didn't look at this. You got a pegboard and a bubble pack, you're going to get money for it.
It's only when you go to trying to sell cell phones with, and focusing on that instead of,
My old friend, Hi Siegel, who was in charge of publicity there for a while, followed the company. He still lives in Fort Worth. And I think you remember they had the slogan, you've got questions, we've got solutions, something like that, right?
Yeah.
And he said, you've got questions, we've got cell phones.
that was very true. Although, when I worked there, the cell phones were the big, huge brick.
Lunchbox.
The lunchbox phones. That was the first
set. And the walkie-talkie phones.
I think I was the walkie-talkie. You're talking the flip phones, or you're talking?
No. Before that, the ones that looked like four rolls of paper towels that were kind of taped together. Not paper towels, but aluminum foil boxes.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. The
like,
big huge
like a World War II handy talk.
The big white one with a big old antenna. Yeah. I remember. I was selling those. Those were the brick phones. Sold the bag phones. Sold the double bricks, like from Lethal Weapon. I was watching Lethal Weapon the other day, and
It's entirely appropriate that you would reach into history, because that really is germane to something that we ought to be covering.
Yeah.
Because, listeners, you're not a hoarder, are you? You're not saving old stereos you haven't listened to for generations in case you need it again.
I'm saving these printer cables. Let me tell you, the Centronics printer cables, they might come in useful. No, honestly, I'm getting rid of those. Go on. Sorry.
So I think it's, I'm not an economics geek. It's not about that. But at some point, you've got to tally up the ways in which hoarding, keeping old stuff really you're never going to use again, how it costs you. I mean, whatever space it's taking, I don't care if it's four cartons in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
If you got rid of those cartons, you could put something else there, and you might get a little elbow room in the house.
So you're
talking about masses, a lot of homes, hundreds of pounds, that you're heating and cooling for decades as you heat and cool everything else in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got a cost. You've got spaces, volumes, places that you could be populating with things that you still use. Keep them at hand and don't have it blocked by, all the Pee Wee Herman dolls that you collected over time. The materials that are in them could go to recycling. And, the supply chain problems right now, if you throw all that copper back in through recycling, if you throw a lot of the paper and cardboard back in, that helps reduce costs for everyone, maybe a tiny fraction each. But how many of us are there? This show must reach, 3 trillion people? I mean, really?
Maybe not that many.
2.5 trillion. Fine.
Okay. A lot closer.
I think all of that can make sense. And if that other stuff wasn't useless, why bother talking about it? USB cables. From before USB 2, what are they going to do for you?
Nothing. Yeah. I mean, even if you use them, they're going to be so slow, so agonizingly slow.
Right. And when's the last time you used a camera that wasn't in your phone?
Okay. So I'm an oddball.
Junkie, so
I've got a few DSLRs, but I have actually – I've gotten rid of my film cameras.
Good.
Yes.
Good, because you can't buy the film or get it developed anymore.
It's a little difficult, yes.
Yeah.
I have to drive half an hour to each way.
I have some very high-quality speakers. As soon as I can dig them out of what I've got stored here, there are a lot of places that look for that arcane high-end stereo stuff. I can turn those into bucks.
Yeah.
That's worth dollars.
Yes.
And that's an economy that has nothing to do with heating.
Well, I'll tell you, my film cameras, when I got rid of those, I got some money for those.
So, the first thing I would suggest to everybody, get a big old carton, two of them.
Mm-hmm.
One labeled useful, one labeled useless.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Get rid of the useless stuff. Productively, if you can find a way to recycle it, get rid of it in any case.
Mm-hmm.
Just be rid of it. It would be facing sanity. You won't be living in 30 years ago quite so often. And if you're in your 30s, you won't be living in 15 years ago quite so often. You know, all of that. Yeah, now, why is it still there? Why? I think, guys, it's your fear of making decisions.
Well, what if I throw this away and I have to buy one of these cables later? Won't that be wasted money?
Why, the cable's going to be a buck and a half. What are you throwing away?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Most cables are not that expensive these days, unless you're buying the unnecessarily marked up version of the cable.
And
I'm not going to name any monster names out there, but we all have an idea there. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation, Microsoft Office 365 Cloud Beginner Tutorial. Thursday, July the 28th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on cybersecurity. Thursday, August the 4th, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 5th, meeting time is 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and their website is acgnj.org. The King's Byte Computer Club has a meeting Tuesday, August the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 11th. Meeting time at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And their website is limac.org. Happy computing! Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.